From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I move to indefinitely postpone the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett.
No, we're not.
To be an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. I believe that this rushed sham process is a disservice to our committee.
Senate Republicans are continuing to rush ahead with confirming Supreme Court Justice nominee Amy Coney Barrett, blocking an attempt by Democrats to postpone the process. We'll speak to Kristen Clark, head of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. She testified at the hearing.
We've conducted an exhaustive review of Judge Barrett's writings, speeches, and decisions during her time on the court. Judge Barrett's views are far outside the mainstream.
Plus, we hear the testimony of a mother from West Virginia who once had an abortion and why she opposes the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett.
President Trump has been clear that he would only appoint justices who would overturn Roe v. Wade. Unfortunately, through learning about Judge Barrett's record, I understand why the president believes she passes the test. Please listen to people who have had abortions. Hear us when we ask you, do not confirm this nominee.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States is approaching 8 million confirmed coronavirus infections, surpassing 64,000 new cases Thursday for the first time since July. More than 1,000 COVID-19 deaths were reported over the last 24 hours, with every region of the U.S. reporting increased hospitalizations. Wisconsin set another statewide record for infections, with more than 3,700 new coronavirus cases reported Thursday. Wisconsin has one of the world's highest test positivity rates, now over 23%. Despite that, President Trump is planning to hold a packed campaign rally in Janesville, Wisconsin, Saturday. This comes as the Wall Street Journal reports throughout the pandemic, White House officials have made line-by-line edits to official health guidance from the Centers for Disease Control, altering language written by scientists on social distancing and rolling back limits on in-person gatherings like church choirs. Globally, new coronavirus infections hit a new record high Thursday, with over 330,000 reported cases. Nearly 39 million people have now contracted the virus worldwide. In France, coronavirus restrictions have been extended to the entire country as growing cases threaten to overwhelm French hospitals. This comes after French police raided the homes of senior government and health officials Thursday as part of an ongoing investigation into their handling of the pandemic. Latin America is also seeing a massive surge of cases. Brazil's death toll has surpassed 152,000 as over 5.1 million people have been infected, the third largest number of infections after the United States and India. The World Health Organization warned Thursday the antiviral drug remdesivir fails to prevent deaths among COVID-19 patients. The WHO's conclusion is based on a study of more than 11,000 patients. It follows smaller, less rigorous studies that found the drug can cut the number of days COVID patients are hospitalized. Remdesivir has been routinely administered to COVID patients in the United States since May, when the FDA granted the drug emergency use authorization. It's one of several drugs administered to President Trump as he battled COVID infection earlier this month. Meanwhile, the WHO is warning even in a best-case scenario, younger, healthier people may have to wait for over a year before they'll be able to receive a vaccine against COVID-19. This is Dr. Soumya Swaminathan, chief scientist at the WHO.
I think for an average person, a healthy young person, might have to wait till 2022. To get a vaccine.
Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett ended Thursday with the right-wing judge's confirmation looking all but assured after four rushed days of questioning in which Barrett refused to state her position on abortion rights, same-sex marriage, the Affordable Care Act, voting rights, climate change, family separation at the U.S.-Mexico border. And even if President Trump could delay the election, The Judiciary Committee is scheduled to vote on Barrett's nomination on October 22nd. The full Senate could vote on whether or not to confirm Barrett as early as October 26th, just about a week before Election Day. We'll have more on the story after headlines. In North Carolina, voters queued in lines for up to 4 hours Thursday as early voting got underway. With less than 3 weeks to go before Election Day, a record 17 million people have already cast ballots, some 15% of the U.S. electorate, many of them in battleground states like Pennsylvania, Florida, and Texas. On Thursday night, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden appeared on ABC for a town hall event scheduled by the campaign after President Trump refused to hold a second debate with Biden virtually after Trump tested positive for coronavirus. During the 90-minute town hall, Biden blasted Trump over his handling of the pandemic and urged people to wear masks and follow other public health measures. Biden also defended elements of his 1994 crime bill, which led to mass incarceration in the U.S., and he said local police departments should be reformed and better funded, not defunded or dismantled.
We shouldn't be defunding cops. We should be mandating the things that we should be doing within police departments and make sure there's total transparency.
As Biden spoke, President Trump appeared at a rival town hall event in Miami, Florida, hosted by NBC. The network's decision to give Trump a simultaneous platform drew from NBC News anchors and journalists. Columbia Journalism Review editor Kyle Pope called it a craven rating stunt. During the one-hour broadcast, Trump falsely claimed 85% of people wearing masks catch coronavirus. He said he was unaware of whether he took a coronavirus test ahead of his debate with Joe Biden in late September and did not deny that he's more than $400 million in debt. Just wouldn't say to who. Pressed by an NBC anchor, Savannah Guthrie, Trump refused to disavow the far-right anti-Semitic QAnon conspiracy theory.
Let me ask you about QAnon. It is this theory that Democrats are a satanic pedophile ring and that you are the savior of that. Now, can you just once and for all state that that is completely not true
so
and disavow QAnon in its entirety?
I know nothing about QAnon.
I just told you.
I know very little. You told me, but what you tell me doesn't necessarily make it fact. I hate to say that. I know nothing about it. I do know they are very much against pedophilia. They fight it very hard, but I know nothing about it.
Trump's own FBI director, Christopher Wray, has identified QAnon as a domestic terrorism threat. Ahead of Thursday's dueling town halls, President Trump rallied some 2,000 supporters in Greenville, North Carolina, where people packed shoulder to shoulder wearing few masks. In a shocking moment, Trump appeared to admit he ordered U.S. Marshals to carry out the extrajudicial killing of anti-fascist activist Michael Reinhold in Washington state on September 3rd.
We sent in the U.S. Marshals. Took 15 minutes, it was over. 15 minutes it was over. We got him. They knew who he was. They didn't want to arrest him. And 15 minutes that ended.
Last month, Trump bragged about Reinhold's killing in an interview with Fox News, saying, quote, there has to be retribution. Reinhold was believed to have killed a far-right protester. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is asking Americans to wear masks and to practice social distancing after he revealed on Thursday he spent a week in an intensive care unit while hospitalized with COVID-19. Christie is one of dozens of people, including President Trump, who became infected after a White House celebration for Trump's Supreme Court nominee in late September. In a statement, former Governor Christie wrote, quote, I was wrong not to wear a mask at the Amy Coney Barrett announcement, and I was wrong not to wear a mask at my multiple debate prep sessions with the president and the rest of the team. I hope that my experience shows my fellow citizens that you should follow CDC guidelines in public, no matter where you are, and wear a mask to protect yourself and others, former Governor Chris Christie wrote. U.S. workers filed nearly 900,000 initial unemployment claims last week amidst fresh signs the U.S. economy is suffering lasting damage due to the pandemic. About 65 million U.S. workers have applied for some form of jobless assistance since the start of the pandemic. This comes as a pair of new studies show 8 million U.S. residents have been forced into poverty since Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell let the CARES Act coronavirus relief bill expire in July. McConnell has refused to hold a Senate vote on the follow-up $3 trillion HEROES Act relief bill passed by House Democrats in May. In Kansas City, housing advocates protesting evictions during the COVID-19 pandemic chained themselves to the front doors of the Jackson County Courthouse in an attempt to shut down the court all day and block eviction hearings. Activists with the group KC Tenants have referred to evictions during the pandemic as acts of violence. In Chicago, ex-police superintendent Eddie Johnson is being accused of repeatedly raping and abusing his former driver and fellow police officer. In a lawsuit filed late Wednesday, Officer Cynthia Donald says Johnson committed shockingly violent acts of sexual assault against her for over 3 years and later destroyed the evidence on his cell phone when the city's inspector general launched an investigation into Johnson's conduct. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot fired Johnson last year following mounting accusations of misconduct and after he was found asleep at the wheel after a night of heavy drinking. This comes as the Chicago Police Department says it will only accept 5 of the 155 proposed changes to its use of force policy suggested by a community group of leaders. The 20-member group was appointed after the May police killing of George Floyd in Minnesota. In Los Angeles, 22-year-old basketball fan William Gonzalez lost vision in his right eye early Monday after he was shot in the face by a police projectile, causing his eye socket to shatter and eyeball to explode. The incident came as the LAPD declared a celebration of the Lakers' NBA championship an unlawful gathering and moved in on the revelers. Other people were also badly injured by police, including a man who lost 8 teeth. The University of Miami used a network of surveillance cameras and facial recognition software to track down students involved in a protest last month against the university's decision to resume in-person classes during the pandemic. That's according to the Miami New Times, which reports that after being identified in surveillance footage, the students received emails ordering them to report to university administrators for questioning. Nebraska's Republican Senator Ben Sasse tore into President Trump on Wednesday over his support of human rights abuses and racists, accusing Trump of personally profiting from the presidency. Senator Sasse's remarks can be heard in a recording of a phone call with constituents published by the Washington Examiner.
The way he kisses dictators' butts, I mean, the way he ignores that the Uyghurs are in literal concentration camps in Xinjiang right now. He hasn't lifted a finger on behalf of the Hong Kongers. The United States now regularly sells out our allies under his leadership. The way he treats women and spends like a drunken sailor, the ways I criticize President Obama for that kind of spending, I've criticized President Trump for as well. He mocks evangelicals behind closed doors. His family has treated the presidency like a business opportunity. He's flirted with white supremacists.
Those are the words of Republican Senator Ben Sasse. Those comments came as the Daily Beast reported right-wing media mogul Rupert Murdoch is predicting Joe Biden will defeat Donald Trump in a landslide. In Colorado, the Cameron Peak Fire has become the largest wildfire in Colorado's history. The fires consume more than 167,000 acres west of Fort Collins, north of Denver. Yemen Houthi rebels have begun exchanging more than 1,000 prisoners with Yemen's Saudi-backed government in the first large-scale prisoner swap since civil war erupted in 2014. UN envoy Martin Griffiths hailed the exchange as an important milestone toward ending conflict in Yemen, where years of attacks by a U.S.-supported Saudi-led coalition have exacerbated a humanitarian crisis that pushed millions to the brink of famine. In a related prisoner exchange, more than 200 Houthi supporters were allowed to return home from Oman in exchange for the release of 2 U.S. citizens held captive by Houthis. This is released American prisoner Mikhail Gdada speaking from Oman just after his release.
American citizen, was living and working in Yemen, and was in prison for 899 days, 2 years and 6 months in solitary confinement, and it was hell. It was really hell.
Mexico's former defense secretary, General Salvador Cienfuegos, was arrested at Los Angeles International Airport Thursday while on a family vacation. He was arrested on a warrant by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. He served as defense secretary from 2012 to 2018 under former Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto. The Mexican magazine Proceso reports the arrest was connected to a corruption probe involving drug traffickers. Cienfuegos was defense secretary in 2014, at the time of the disappearance and presumed massacre of 43 students from a teacher's college in Ayotzinapa, Guerrero, Mexico. Last month, Mexican authorities issued arrest warrants for soldiers in connection with the massacre. And in Georgia, a Catholic priest has been sentenced to 33 months in jail for breaking into the Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base in Georgia to protest U.S. nuclear weapons policy. Father Steve Kelly is part of the Kings Bay Plowshare 7, a group of Catholic peace activists who entered the base in 2018 armed with hammers, crime scene tape, baby bottles containing their own blood, and an indictment charging the U.S. government with crimes against peace. The base is home to at least six nuclear ballistic missile submarines, each of which carries 20 Trident thermonuclear weapons. Father Kelly has been locked up since his arrest on April 4, 2018, so he has already served nearly all of his 33-month sentence, which included time served. Another member of the Kings Bay Plowshare 7, Patrick O'Neill, is being sentenced today. To see all of our coverage of the Kings Bay Plowshares, visit democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The Quarantine Report. When we come back, we look at the Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett. Stay with us.
The judge said, screw 'em, boys, you're only human. They brought it on themselves by being born a woman, like a mountain's there to climb and food's there to be eaten. Woman's there to rape, to be shoved around and beaten.
The judge took his position, the judge he wouldn't budge. So we got out this petition and we're gonna screw the judge.
Now if you beat a horse or dog or violate a bank, Simonson will haul you in and throw you in the crank. But violate a woman, your equal and your peer, the judge will slap you on the wrist and lay the blame on her.
The Judge Said, by Malvina Reynolds. This is Democracy Now!, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Amy Coney Barrett ended Thursday with the right-wing judge's confirmation looking all but assured after 4 rush days of questioning in which Barrett refused to state her position on abortion rights, on same-sex marriage, on the Affordable Care Act, on voting rights, climate change, and even if President Trump could delay the election. If confirmed, Barrett will give conservatives a 6-3 majority on the high court. The hearing's final day kicked off with Senate Republicans in the Judiciary Committee voting to schedule a vote on Barrett's Supreme Court confirmation for October 22nd. Republican Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Lindsey Graham called for a vote before the hearing had even finished and without enough Democrats present in the room. Senator Dick Durbin, the sole Democrat present, attempted to adjourn the meeting in response.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
You cannot conduct that business without another minority member present.
These are all the dates.
And so at this point, I'm going to make a motion to adjourn this meeting until we have completed the hearing on Amy Coney Barrett. We still have a panel before us. This is unprecedented. We have never done this before as a committee. And if we are going to honor the rules and show mutual respect, the fact is we cannot move forward.
Senator Durbin, with all due respect, we've had this problem in the past. We're dealing with it the way we are today. If we create this problem for you in the future, you're going to do what I'm going to do. which is move forward on the business of the committee. On the motion, the clerk will call the roll.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said the move solidified, quote, the illegitimacy of this sham process, unquote. If the Senate Judiciary Committee approves Judge Barrett's confirmation on October 22nd, the full Senate could vote on whether or not to confirm her as early as October 26, just about a week before Election Day. This has never happened before. Senate Majority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell said Thursday Republicans have the votes needed to confirm her. On Thursday, Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut moved to suspend the hearing indefinitely.
I move to indefinitely postpone the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett.
No, we're not.
To be an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. I believe that this rushed sham process is a disservice to our committee. She has been rushed in a way that is historically unprecedented. There's never been a nomination in an election year after the month of July, and the purpose of doing it is simply to have a justice on the Supreme Court, as the president said, to decide the election and to strike down the Affordable Care Act. We've had inadequate time to review this nomination, as indicated most recently, yesterday, a CNN report that there are seven more speeches or talks that she has given that have not been disclosed to this committee. The consequence of this rush process is that we've given inadequate scrutiny to this nominee. I move to delay these proceedings so that we can do our job.
Senator Blumenthal was referencing a CNN report that revealed Judge Barrett did not disclose seven talks recorded on the University of Notre Dame Law School's public calendar, including one with an anti-choice group in 2007. CNN also uncovered evidence she gave two talks in 2013 to anti-choice groups at the school. Under Senate rules, Barrett is required to provide a list of all public talks she's given in her professional career. Blumenthal's motion to suspend the hearing indefinitely was denied along party lines. Despite outcry from Democrats about the rush nomination process and how Judge Barrett's role on the court could end health care for millions and threaten Roe v. Wade, California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein ended the hearing thanking Senate Judiciary Chair Lindsey Graham for his leadership.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank you. This has been one of the best set of hearings that I've participated in, and I want to thank you for your fairness.
The 87-year-old ranking Democrat then hugged Graham, who's refused to be tested for the coronavirus. Neither of them wore masks. Well, for more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Kristen Clark, President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. She testified at Judge Barrett's confirmation hearing on Thursday. Kristen, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Why don't you start off? This is just after you yourself have testified remotely because of COVID at this hearing. Start off by talking about the significance of what you heard this week and also what has actually taken place here, the unprecedented nature of this taking place as people are voting all over the country for the next president of the United States.
Well, thank you for having me. This is a historic nomination because this has never happened before. We have never had a president put forth a nomination and commence confirmation hearings in the middle of an ongoing presidential election. According to Michael McDonald, who runs the Elections Project, as of yesterday, about 20 million Americans have cast their ballots. And for many of those Americans, those may be people for whom the Supreme Court is top of mind. Those are people who are exercising their right to determine who will be president and who will sit in those senatorial seats to carry out the constitutional role of filling a Supreme Court vacancy. Throughout our nation's history, presidents have respected the fact that the voters deserve voice in this process, which is why we have never seen a nomination take place at this moment. There are two instances that Senator Graham talked about in which vacancies were filled late in the year. Those were vacancies filled by presidents who were actually reelected, one of whom was reelected, and that president's party also gained a deeper majority in the Senate. So I want to just underscore how unprecedented this moment is, because it truly politicizes the Supreme Court in dangerous ways, in ways that may undermine the public's confidence and faith in the court. We also cannot ignore President Trump's prerogative, President Trump's objective here. He has made very clear that he wants a full 9-member court to decide any disputes which he anticipates may or may not arise from this election. He wants a 9-member court in place by November 10th to hear the Affordable Care Act case. So that loomed heavy this week throughout the hearings. I thought that what happened yesterday morning was incredibly important. Senator Blumenthal put forth a motion to suspend the process. They raced forward this week in the middle of a pandemic. They started the process on a federal holiday. They did so while the Senate actually was in recess. They've turned attention away from the emergency needs that the public faces in the middle of the pandemic to turn attention to this. And as you noted, it's continuing to surface that there are aspects of her record that have not yet surfaced. The senator's motion ultimately failed and the hearing went forward. But I thought that it was important that that we had an opportunity to shine a light on what a broken process this is, what a rushed process this is. We're talking about a lifetime seat on our nation's highest court. And that should be a seat filled after the Senate is able to carefully carry out its duty to provide advice and consent by thoroughly looking at and examining every aspect of her record, leaving no stone unturned. That said, Amy, my organization, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, conducted a thorough examination of her record, at least the record that has been made public. We looked at her speeches during her time at Notre Dame, her writings, and her opinions during her short tenure on the Seventh Circuit. We found that she failed the second prong of our standard, which looks to determine whether or not the nominee is someone who will bring an exceptional commitment to enforcement of our federal civil rights laws and the Constitution. And what was really striking this week was to see Judge Barrett go to great lengths to distance herself from the reality of voting discrimination that we face in our country. She was asked basic questions. Is voter intimidation illegal? And she would not agree to this proposition. And voter intimidation is plainly illegal under Section 11B of the Voting Rights Act. It violates federal criminal laws. She was asked whether voting discrimination is ongoing. This was during questioning with Senator Harris, and she refused to answer that question as
well. I want to go to her questioning on this issue by Minnesota Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar.
Last week, a contractor from outside of my state of Minnesota started recruiting poll watchers with special forces experience to protect polling locations in my state. This was clear voter intimidation. Similar efforts are going on around the country, solicited by President Trump's false claims of massive voter fraud. So as a result of his claims, people are trying to get poll watcher, special forces people to go to the polls. Judge Barrett, under federal law, is it illegal to intimidate voters at the polls?
Senator Klobuchar, I can't characterize the facts in a hypothetical situation, and I can't apply the law to a hypothetical set of facts. I can only decide cases as they come to me, litigated by parties on a full record after fully engaging precedent, talking to colleagues, writing an opinion. And so I can't answer questions like that.
That's Judge Barrett. The significance of this response, Kristen Clark.
Well, there is nothing hypothetical about voter intimidation. We are in the middle of an election season where we know voter suppression is alive and well. We've heard the reports about intimidating poll watchers showing up at satellite voting centers in Philadelphia. And voter intimidation, sadly, has been a stain on our democracy throughout our nation's history. So it was deeply troubling that Judge Barrett was unwilling to acknowledge basic aspects about American life, that the right to vote is central, but that the right to vote has been under attack for Black people, for Latinos, and for communities of color, that voter intimidation is real. I could accept aspects of her response that, you know, I'd need to actually look at a particular scenario in order to determine whether or not it violates the Constitution or federal law. But to not tell the American public that she would come to the bench with a basic understanding that voting discrimination is real, that voter intimidation does happen, is deeply, deeply troubling.
I wanted to turn to another issue that is so deeply concerned people all over this country, and that is the issue of reproductive rights, whether we're talking about IVF or infertile couples, or whether we're talking about the issue of abortion. Crystal Good testified about her experience having an abortion, expressing concerns that Barrett's confirmation would limit access to safe, abortable care. During 3 days of hearings, Judge Barrett repeatedly refused to answer questions about her views on abortion and the future of Roe v. Wade, despite her public record opposing reproductive rights. This is Good's opening statement.
My name is Crystal Good, and I'm a sixth-generation West Virginian, a writer-poet, a small business owner, graduate student at West Virginia University, and an advocate for survivors of sexual abuse. I'm the daughter of a white mother and a Black father, and I'm the proud mother of three brilliant children. These identities are all parts of me, but not all of me. Who I am today is only possible because at 16 years old, I had access to an abortion. As a minor in a state with a parental consent requirement, that access was dependent on a judge, because without a shadow of a doubt, I could not trust the adults closest to me. From the ages of 5 until I was 15, I was sexually abused by my white stepfather. He wasn't convicted until 2012, more than 30 years after the abuse began. When I told the grown folks in my life, they didn't believe me at first, and then refused to hold my abuse accountable once the truth was out. Later at 16, while in a relationship that brought me joy and made me feel safe, I, like 2.7 million Americans a year, had an unintended pregnancy. Immediately, I knew I wanted an abortion, a very safe medical procedure that 1 in 4 U.S. women will have in their lifetimes. For many reasons, including the decade of abuse she did not protect me from, I couldn't tell my mother. Instead, I sought a judicial bypass. I had to navigate not only how to get to the judge, but how to do so on a school day. I had no idea what I should wear or what information he would want. I thought I was going to court like on TV, but instead I was ushered into his chambers. It felt very intimidating. I told him I was a good student. I was a leader in my school. I had opportunities that many young women from West Virginia didn't. I wanted to go to college, to be a writer. I said, Your Honor, I have a future. I choose an abortion. It felt like a miracle. An adult believed me. An authority figure deemed me to be in charge of my own body and my own future. I still think what might have happened if I didn't have a list of accomplishments, or if the judge didn't think I was competent enough to decide when to start my family, or if he believed the harmful stereotype I was raised to believe that Black girls were fast and promiscuous. Access to an abortion should not depend on our GPA, the color of our skin, where we live, or the luck of the draw. It should not depend in any shape, form, or fashion who your governor is or who is sitting on the Supreme Court. My entire childhood, every adult in my life had failed me. None of them deserved to make a decision about my body. I needed compassion and trust from my government. All I got was another barrier. There are thousands like me who are sexually abused by parents, guardians, and grown-ups who are supposed to support them. Today, 37 states require parental consent or notification for a minor to access abortion. Most young people do involve their parents in their decision. But for those like me who cannot, these kinds of restrictions make abortion hard to get because we have to travel, miss work or school, save up for weeks, and pay out of pocket. The average per capita income in West Virginia is $25,479. That's one-seventh of your Senate salaries. In Central Appalachia, Black and low-income white people struggle to access health care, including abortion, and to have our decisions respected. The Supreme Court has made historic decisions that uphold our rights and freedoms. My right to an abortion, the integration of my public schools, the Affordable Health Care Act that ensures that I have health insurance, and workplace protections for my transgender daughter. I have put my faith in the Supreme Court, and with this nomination, I am losing faith. Although the way I have chosen to create my family is demonized by some politicians, the reality is that we're like most families across the nation. I had an abortion. I have two sons and a daughter who is trans. I love my children. We are a proud Afro-Latchian family. That's African American Appalachian. My story is my own, but represents so many people left out from the Supreme Court nominee hearings. An entire caste of people. That's C-A-S-T-E, caste. President Trump has been clear that he would only appoint justices who would overturn Roe v. Wade. Unfortunately, through learning about Judge Barrett's record, I understand why the president believes she passes the test. Please listen to people who have had abortions. Hear us when we ask you, do not confirm this nominee. Our futures, our families, our lives depend on it. We too are America.
That's Crystal Good, a West Virginia mother, testifying Thursday against Judge Amy Coney Barrett, who once signed a newspaper advertisement that stated, "It's time to put an end to the barbaric legacy of Roe v. Wade and restore laws that protect the lives of unborn children." Kristen Clark, I want to ask you about this, particularly in light of what Judge Barrett said in 2006 at a commencement address at Notre Dame. She said, "Keep in mind that your legal career is but a means to an end. And as Father Jenkins told you this morning, that end is building the kingdom of God." Kristen.
If confirmed, Judge Barrett will be a fifth vote to eviscerate the important protections that have been afforded by Roe v. Wade. I thought that Crystal Good's testimony yesterday was incredibly powerful. It was courageous of her to share her personal testimony, and it's an experience shared by so many women across our country who rely on the court's precedent in Roe to ensure their dignity, to ensure their ability and freedom to make their own personal choices about their bodies. I believe that Senator Graham freely described Judge Barrett as pro-life. We looked at her record, and in addition to that petition that you referenced, Amy, she wrote an article in 2013 there was an article that appeared in 2013 in the Notre Dame magazine that referenced a speech that she gave called Roe at 40. And they described her as speaking of Roe as a case that created through judicial fiat a framework of abortion on demand in a political environment that was already liberalizing abortion regulations state by state, igniting a national controversy. There were moments where she was asked whether she deemed Roe v. Wade a super precedent. She refused to subscribe that label to the decision. And some of the cases that have come before her on the Seventh Circuit have made clear that she has deep skepticism about Roe. I believe that if confirmed, she will prove to be that fifth vote that chips away, if not guts, and rolls back the important protections long afforded by Roe v. Wade.
Kristen Clark, in your testimony yesterday, you talked about issues of racial justice, particularly the case of Smith v. Illinois Department of Transportation, a worker there, and the N-word. Describe why you felt this was so critical.
Well, I thought that it was important to bring these cases up because they show a pattern in which she has tended to put the interests of corporations and employers over the interests of vulnerable employees. Smith versus Illinois Department of Transportation involved a black traffic patrol driver who alleged that he was subjected to a hostile work environment. And among the various pieces of evidence presented in that case was the fact that he was subjected to use of the N-word in the workspace repeatedly. And Judge Barrett did concede that the N-word is, quote, an egregious racial epithet, but ultimately concluded that this was not enough to prove that he was subjected to the sort of racial hostility that was enough to prove discrimination under Title VII in this case. And then there was another case that we've heard about during the week, EEOC versus AutoZone. This is a case involving AutoZone's decision to assign workers to different sites based on their race. They would assign black workers to particular store based on the race of the employee and based on the predominant race of employees served, and they did the same with Latinos. And here, the client who is at the center of this case was a black worker assigned to the south side of Chicago. Ultimately, the court found that employees were still paid the same and received the same benefits and had the same job responsibilities. And so Judge Barrett refused to rehear that case. But I think that that's very dangerous. I mean, this is AutoZone essentially putting in a separate but equal racial doctrine in the workplace. I think that the sum total of these two cases makes clear that she will likely look at cases involving allegations of discrimination with great skepticism and will likely always, if not the majority of time, side with corporations and employers. And that's unfortunate. As a civil rights lawyer, we bring cases on behalf of vulnerable communities to the court and do so hoping that egregious facts like this, racial policies, racial segregation in the workplace, use of the N-word. I mean, these are the kind of smoking gun cases that we seek to bring to the courts to vindicate the rights of those most vulnerable in our society.
Well, Kristen Clark, we want to ask if you'll stay with us. You're talking about corporate power. And in our next segment, we're going to play an excerpt of the Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, who takes us on a journey following the dark money trail and how it's reshaped the nation's judiciary. And then we want to get your final comments. Kristen Clark is the executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Stay with us.
Oh, mama, mama, look there. Your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns jammed downtown. The killing clowns, the blood money men. The shooting froze. Washington bullets again. As every cell in Chile will tell the cries of the tortured men. Remember Allende and the days before, before the army came. Please remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium. Verdad, those Washington bullets again. And in the Bay of Pigs in 1961, Havana for the Playboy in the Cuban sun. For Castro is the color is a redder than red. Those Washington bullets want Castro dead. For Castro is the color. The bullet is a spray of lead.
Washington bullets by the Clark. class. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our coverage of the now-concluded hearings for Supreme Court Justice nominee Amy Coney Barrett, we turn to Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. On Tuesday, he opted not to ask Judge Barrett any questions. Instead, he gave a 30-minute presentation on how right-wing groups, including the Federalist Society and Judicial Crisis Network, have used dark money to reshape the nation's judiciary. This is an excerpt.
My experience around politics is that when you find hypocrisy in the daylight, look for power in the shadows. Now, people may say, well, what does all this matter? This is a political parlor game. It's no big deal. Well, there are some pretty high stakes here that we've been talking about here on our side. And I'll tell you three of them right here. Roe versus Wade, Obergefell, and the Obamacare cases. In all cases, there's big anonymous money behind various lanes of activity. One lane of activity is through the conduit of the Federalist Society. It's managed by a guy, was managed by a guy named Leonard Leo, and it's taken over the selection of judicial nominees. How do we know that to be the case? Because Trump has said so over and over again. His White House counsel said so. So we have an anonymously funded group controlling judicial selection run by this guy, Leonard Leo. Then in another lane, we have, again, anonymous funders running through something called the Judicial Crisis Network, which is run by Carrie Severino, and it's doing PR and campaign ads for Republican judicial nominees. It got $17 million donation in the Garland Gorsuch contest. It got another single $17 million donation to support Kavanaugh. Somebody, perhaps the same person, spent $35 million to influence the makeup of the United States Supreme Court. Tell me that's good. And then over here, you have a whole array of legal groups, also funded by dark money, which have a different role. They bring cases to the court. They don't wind their way to the court, Your Honor. They get shoved to the court by these legal groups, many of which ask to lose below so they can get quickly to the court to get their business done there. And then they turn up in a chorus, an orchestrated chorus of amici. Now, I've had a chance to have a look at this, and I was in a case, actually, as an amicus myself, the Consumer Financial Protection Board case. And in that case, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 amicus briefs filed, and every single one of them was a group funded by something called Donors Trust. Donors Trust is a gigantic identity scrubbing device for the right wing so that it says donors trust is the donor without whoever the real donor is. It doesn't have a business. It doesn't have a business plan. It doesn't do anything. It's just an identity scrubber. And this group here, the Bradley Foundation, funded 8 out of the 11 briefs. That seems weird to me when you have amicus briefs coming in little flotillas that are funded by the same groups but nominally separate in the court. So I actually attached this to my brief as an appendix. Center for Media and Democracy saw it, and they did better work. They went on to say which foundations funded the brief writers in that CFPB case. Here's the Bradley Foundation for $5.6 million to those groups. Here's Donors Trust, $23 million to those brief writing groups. The grand total across all the donor groups was $68 million to the groups that were filing amicus briefs, pretending that they were different groups. And it's not just in the Consumer Financial Protection Board case. You might say, well, that was just a one-off. Here's Janus, the anti-labor case that had a long trail through the court, through Friedrichs and through Knox and through other decisions. And SourceWatch and ProPublica did some work about this. Here's Donors Trust and Donors Capital Fund, and here's the Bradley Foundation, and they totaled giving $45 million to the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 groups that filed amicus briefs pretending to be different groups, and both of the lawyer groups in the case. Funded by Donors Trust, funded by Bradley Foundation in Janus. This is happening over and over and over again, and it goes beyond just the briefs. It goes beyond just the amicus presentations. The Federalist Society, remember this group that is acting as the conduit and that Donald Trump has said is doing his judicial selection? They're getting money from the same foundations. From Donors Trust, $16.7 million. From the Bradley Foundation, $1.37 million. From the same group of foundations total, $33 million. So you can start to look at these and you can start to tie them together. The legal groups, all the same funders over and over again, bringing the cases and providing this orchestrated chorus of amici. This is a, to me, pretty big deal. I've never seen this around any court that I've ever been involved with, where there's this much dark money and this much influence being used. Here's how the Washington Post summed it up. This is a conservative activist behind-the-scenes campaign to remake the nation's courts, and it's a $250 million dark money operation. But there's another piece of it, and that is not what's ahead of us, but what's behind us. What's behind us is now 80 cases, Mr. Chairman, 80 cases under Chief Justice Roberts that have these characteristics. One, they were decided 5-4 by a bare majority. Two, the 5-4 majority was partisan in the sense that not one Democratic appointee joined the five. I refer to that group as the Roberts Five. It changes a little bit, as with Justice Scalia's death, for instance. But there's been a steady Roberts Five that has delivered now 80 of these decisions. And the last characteristic of them is that there is an identifiable Republican donor interest in those cases. And in every single case, that donor interest won. And it's important to look at where those cases went, because they're not about big public issues like getting rid of the Affordable Care Act, undoing Roe versus Wade, and undoing same-sex marriage. They're about power. And if you look at those 80 decisions, they fall into four categories over and over and over again. One, unlimited and dark money in politics. Citizens United is the famous one, but it's continued since with McCutcheon, and we've got one coming up now. Next, knock the civil jury down. Whittle it down to a nub. The civil jury was in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, in our darn Declaration of Independence. But it's annoying to big corporate powers, because you can swagger your way as a big corporate power through Congress. You can go and tell the president you put money into to elect what to do. He'll put your stooges at the EPA. It's all great until you get to the civil jury, because they have an obligation. As you know, Judge Barrett, they have an obligation under the law to be fair to both parties, irrespective of their size. You can't bribe them. You're not allowed to. It's a crime to tamper with a jury. It's standard practice to tamper with Congress. Third, first was unlimited dark money. Second was demean and diminish the civil jury. Third is weaken regulatory agencies. A lot of this money, I'm convinced, is polluter money. The Coke Industries is a polluter. The fossil fuel industry is a polluter. Who else would be putting buckets of money into this and wanting to hide who they are behind Donors Trust or other schemes? And what if you're a big polluter, what do you want? You want weak regulatory agencies. You want ones that you can box up and run over to Congress and get your friends to fix things for you in Congress. And the last thing is in politics, in voting. Why on earth the court made the decision, a factual decision, not something appellate courts are ordinarily supposed to make, as I understand it, Judge Barrett, the factual decision that nobody needed to worry about minority voters in preclearance states being discriminated against or that legislators would try to knock back their ability to vote. These five made that finding in Shelby County against bipartisan legislation from both houses of Congress, hugely passed on no factual record. They just decided that that was a problem that was over. On no record, with no basis, because it got them to the result that we then saw. What followed? State after state after state passed voter suppression laws. One so badly targeting African Americans that the two courts said it was surgically tailored to get after minority voters. In all these areas where it's about political power for big special interests and people who want to fund campaigns and people who want to get their way through politics without actually showing up, doing it behind donors' trust and other groups, doing it through these schemes, over and over and over again, you see the same thing. 80 decisions, Judge Barrett. Something is not right around the court. And dark money has a lot to do with it. Special interests have a lot to do with it. Donors trust and whoever's hiding behind donors trust has a lot to do with it. And the Bradley Foundation orchestrating its amici over at the court has a lot to do with it.
That's Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island speaking at the Supreme Court Justice confirmation hearings for Amy Coney Barrett, talking about how dark money has reshaped the nation's judiciary. In these last few minutes, we're still with Kristen Clark, President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, who also testified on the last day of the hearings. Kristen, if you can underscore this dark money trail and what it has meant for your work. And then include in this, as we wrap up for the week, we are in the voting season. It's not just an election day anymore. Something like 15% of the electorate has already voted, many new voters, and the obstacles that are being put in their way.
Well, I thought that Senator Whitehouse's remarks were incredibly important. We need to pull back the veil. We need to shine a light and have more transparency on how the Federalist Society and Donors Network and all of these other related organizations operate. They have become a powerful, well-funded force in terms of transforming the courts. As a civil rights organization, we have become deeply concerned about the grip that they have on the judicial nomination process. We have seen them put forth nominees who are not diverse. They have rolled the clock back on racial and gender diversity in our federal courts. We've seen nominees whose records reflect extremism, nominees who are far outside the mainstream. So understanding the funding trail for these organizations is incredibly important. And it's a reminder about the devastating 2010 Supreme Court decision in Citizens United, which has made transparency when it comes to donations all the more difficult. To your question, Amy, about where we are right now, we are in the middle of a pandemic that has upended elections across our country. But it has been remarkable to see the secretaries of states in a number of places really be very proactive in recognizing that fact. Secretaries of states that have lifted some of the barriers and burdens that voters face when it comes to accessing absentee ballots, when it comes to notary and witness requirements for voters who may be quarantined at their home because of their health. But organizations like mine, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, have been working day and night in the courts to address some of those states that have failed to lift the barriers. Some of the bad actors include Texas, Tennessee.
You have 5 seconds.
Georgia, Texas, Tennessee, and others. My hope is that all voters who want to have voice will be able to do so in the days that remain in the 2020 election.
Kristen Clark, I want to thank you so much for being with us. President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. That does it for our broadcast. Just remember, in these last days leading up to the final election day, stay safe, save lives, wear a mask, and vote.